Good evening and welcome to the University of Virginia School of Law. My name is Paul Mahoney and I'm the Dean of the Law School. It's an honor for the law school to host the 13th annual Henry J. Abraham Lecture, and a particular pleasure to welcome Nadine Strossen, one of the most influential lawyers of our era. The lecture's sponsor is the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Freedom of Expression. Founded by Robert O'Neill, a former president of the university and a longtime member of the law school faculty. The lecture honors Henry Abraham and was established by his colleagues and former students. You will hear more about Henry in a minute, but I will just note that if anyone deserves to be called a citizen of the entire university, Henry would be the person. While his appointment is in the politics department, his ties to the law school run deep, and you would hear the same thing from other deans and department chairs across grounds. Henry is a resource and indeed a treasure for all of us who teach and research in Charlottesville. I'm going to turn the podium over to one of Henry's former students and a member of the steering committee for the lecture, Professor Barbara Perry. I'm delighted that Barbara is now right down the street as a senior fellow at the Miller Center of Public Affairs here at the university. She was previously the Carter Glass Professor of Government at Sweetbriar College and is an expert on the U.S. Supreme Court. Barbara will say a few words about Henry. On behalf of the law school and the university, thank you for your presence today, and I expect that Nadine Strossen's lecture will amply reward it. Thanks.
Thank you, Dean Mahoney, for your very kind welcoming remarks and for offering the law school as a most appropriate venue for the annual Abraham Lecture. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for attending the 13th annual Henry J. Abraham Distinguished Lecture to be delivered today by Professor Nadine Strossen of New York Law School, a civil libertarian extraordinaire whose distinguished career is a testament to the honor that we bestow on Henry each year at this event. In my capacity as chair of the Abraham Lectureship Steering Committee, I want to extend my deep appreciation to those many of you, family, friends, colleagues, and students of Henry, who make this lectureship possible with your continuing generosity. As many of you know, I'm a scholar of the Kennedy presidency, and I take every opportunity to insert Kennedy or Sorensen quotations into my lectures. As I was thinking about Henry's long life, and he would be the first to tell you that he will achieve nonagenarian status this coming August, as I was thinking about that, a famous segment of JFK's inaugural address came to mind. You're familiar, I know, with the introductory passage of it. Let the word go forth from this time and place that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans. But the remainder of the quote seems particularly apposite, to use a favorite Henry term. Kennedy described his generation as born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed. The excerpt occurred to me for several reasons. Henry is a member of Kennedy's greatest generation, as we now call them, who were born in the first quarter of the 20th century and courageously faced all of its horrors and challenges. As a 15-year-old in 1937, Henry bid goodbye to his beloved parents and younger brother in his hometown of Offenbach, Germany, to set out by train and then ocean liner for a lonely transatlantic voyage to the United States, where he knew only a handful of relatives and classroom English. He could only hope and pray that his immediate family would survive the Third Reich's persecutions, and thankfully they did and joined him in Pittsburgh a year later. In the interim, he lived with a family who took in refugees, and he attempted to fathom the mysteries of a large, diverse public high school. Like Kennedy, Henry's iron will would be tempered by war. Though he had escaped the enemy, the U.S. paradoxically declared him an enemy alien, which didn't prevent the government from drafting him into the army and assigning this brilliant trilingual young man to be a pole climber in the Signal Corps. Yet proving that the phrase military intelligence is not an oxymoron, the army eventually transferred him to G2 because by then he was fluent in English, French, and German, and then shipped him overseas to France and Germany, where he began the odious duty of interrogating German POWs. Back in his native country, Henry learned that two of his aunts had perished at Auschwitz, but that one had miraculously survived the Warsaw Ghetto, and he rescued her. After VE Day in May 1945, he was assigned to the Berlin Document Center and began researching the efficient triplicate files of the Nazi Party to be used as evidence at the Nuremberg war crimes trials. Henry's discipline did not flow from JFK's hard and bitter peace, but from his implacable Teutonic absolute commitment to timeliness, neatness, and organization, which is why I was the perfect research assistant for him here at UVA with my own Germanic background, disciplined by a hard and bitter 8 years of Catholic grade school. When peacetime allowed Henry to pursue his education after World War II, he applied the same single-mindedness to earning a BA in political science on the GI Bill, summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa at his cherished Kenyon College, an MA in public law and government at Columbia University, and a PhD in political science at Penn. It made perfect sense that a boy whose life had been turned upside down by the terror perpetrated by a totalitarian dictator would then devote his adult life to studying and teaching the human rights to which his adopted nation has been committed. Constitutional government and the rule of law it promotes have formed the core of Henry's teaching and publications over his 6 decades as a scholar of the judicial process, especially the U.S. Supreme Court. He has written the seminal, definitive books on those subjects, and I draw your attention to them in your brochure today and in Henry's Wikipedia entry. And to use once more President Kennedy's felicitous metaphor, Henry has passed the torch of enlightenment to new generations. The father of one of his several thousand undergraduates here at UVA recently wrote to me, "I want Professor Abraham to know that my wife joins me in our appreciation for the personal attention and friendship that he extended to our son while attending UVA. He was instrumental in all that our son has accomplished in his young professional career as a lawyer. It is because of the dedication of individuals like Professor Abraham that his country has young people becoming significant contributors to society." And Henry continues to impart his wisdom to older generations as well, those over 55 years of age who are eligible to sign up for his courses in UVA's OLLIE program, which is dedicated to lifelong learning. My favorite course evaluation for Henry exclaimed, "Henry Abraham is a national treasure," which is why the 12 past Abraham lecturers, distinguished chief justices, associate justices, appeals court judges, scholars, generals, journalists, and lawyers have come to the University of Virginia to honor him year after year. Today, several of them have returned to join in another round of encomia for Henry. U.S. Court of Appeals Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson III, General William K. Souter, Clerk of the Supreme Court of the United States, and Professor Tinsley Yarborough. In addition, we are honored to have with us Mrs. Mimi Clark Grunlund, daughter of the late U.S. Supreme Court Associate Justice Tom C. Clark and her family, as well as U.S. District Court Judge for the Eastern District of Virginia, Mark Davis, another former student of Henry here at UVA. And I would now like to ask Henry to stand and be recognized by us today. Sadly, we recently lost the 2009 Abraham Lecturer, Chief Justice Leroy Hessel of the Virginia Supreme Court. He was the first African-American Chief Justice of the Commonwealth's highest tribunal, and what made his appearance here 2 years ago so special was the fact that he was another of Henry's students who had gone on to an acclaimed life of service in the law. Each year, we take this opportunity to thank publicly the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression, without which there might not be an Abraham Lecture. And we certainly want to thank its founding director, Bob O'Neill, and Josh Wheeler and Amy McClung, who have helped make this event possible each year. Bob will be retiring from the center's directorship, though not from his busy life of scholarship and service in DC at the end of this month. And we know that Josh Wheeler will be an admirable successor to him. We want to thank Bob for all of his service to the Abraham Lecture. And as I call him to the podium for his introduction of our speaker today, we want to present him with a special gift. Bob? This is not a gold watch, but it's a gold bag. And inside is Justice Stephen Breyer's latest book, called Making Democracy Work, which we thought was particularly important and appropriate for Bob and Henry and Nadine here today. And it is signed by Justice Breyer, thanks to Henry's intercessions. And it is inscribed to Bob with admiration and to my friend of many years, Steve.
Oh, wonderful. Perfect. Thank you so much, Barbara. At first, looking at the bag, I assumed it was a Jefferson cup. Whenever in doubt, you can always assume there's a Jefferson cup in there somewhere. But Justice Breyer's book is far more immediately valuable in all sorts of ways and constitutes a treasure of its own. I'm deeply grateful. I just wanted to take a moment to thank Paul Mahoney for having been, I believe, the purveyor of the first formal welcome on behalf of a law school dean. It did take 13 years for us to achieve this noble status, but I'm awfully glad that Paul joined us and added his welcome as well. Obviously, Barbara has given us perspective on Henry's role and manifold contributions, which we honor and acclaim each year as half of our tribute, in addition to welcoming, as we do also, a distinguished colleague as our lecturer. Not surprisingly, Henry's advice and counsel have been sought every time a vacancy on the Supreme Court emerged, or even when there's been serious speculation about that prospect. That role on Henry's part is appropriate and logical. One columnist that I recently read described his justices and presidents as, quote, the indispensable work on the entire subject. Another recent media commenter called him, quote, the dean of political scientists who specializes in the judicial process. Just a few years ago, he was honored through yet another well-deserved tribute, the 2007 DAR Americanism Medal, and the acclaim continues to accumulate for his latest work, Justices, Presidents, and Senators, A History of the U.S. Supreme Court Appointments from Washington to Bush II, and I'm sure there will be an Obama chapter before very long. Now to our 13th Henry Abraham Lecture, an old friend and longtime colleague whom I'm delighted to welcome this afternoon. Of all those who have graced this podium, I've been struck by singular parallels between this year's two honorees. Despite an obvious difference in age and gender, there's a deeply shared commitment to civil liberties, which marks equally the career of Professor Strassen as that of Professor Abraham. Indeed, if you were to acclaim or identify the preeminent exemplar of civil rights and civil liberties, I don't think there would be much serious doubt that honor should go to Nadine Strassen. Her background is both admirable and impressive. She achieved high honors both at Harvard College and at Harvard Law School, serving as an editor of the Harvard Law Review. After some years of private practice in Minneapolis, not exactly the place where I suspect most of us, I having grown up in Cambridge, for example, would have expected to find her, but happily she did contribute, and then happily for many years has been a member of the faculty of the New York Law School, where she continues to write and teach. Obviously, most notable among her achievements has been her 17 years as president of the American Civil Liberties Union. Guiding even a fairly docile group through nearly two decades would have been quite an achievement. Given the sometimes volatile and challenging nature of such an organization, happens to be one of which I've been a proud card-carrying member for nearly half a century. In this case, it's been nothing less than a miracle. A Along the way, she's mastered the core challenges of the millennium, from urging full First Amendment protection for electronic expression, to rejecting political correctness categorically and in a variety of ways, condemning restrictive speech codes, disparaging anti-pornography laws and curbs on protests, even by the most hateful and spiteful of groups. Despite the range of her published scholarship and eloquent public advocacy, a recent article noted that she, in the author's words, never misses a class, a commitment to which our lecture committee has been keenly aware. It was not easy to find the right date and the right match, but it did emerge. This engaging profile, the one I just quoted, entitled, by the way, Becoming Nadine Strossen, remarked along the way that even after leaving the helm of the ACLU, her energy and creativity abated not the least. During what she modestly described to the reporter as a light day, this observer noted that she was preparing for 7 speeches and 3 law school lectures, all of which she would deliver in the very next week. Yet, she also made her theater debut as a guest star in Eve Ensler's award-winning Vagina Monologues. She is, in the very best sense, a truly Renaissance person. We welcome warmly and gratefully our 13th Abraham Lecturer, Professor Nadine Strossen.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction and warm welcome. And since I heard a little bit of chortling when Bob was talking about some of the contention that goes on at the ACLU National Board, I thought I would share with you a little vignette. The ACLU National Board, if you can believe it, has 83 people, most of whom are lawyers. And you know, for the from the outside world's perspective, we all agree with each other, right? Not. We get together for entire weekends, 2 days, from early in the morning till late at night, and argue so strenuously and vociferously. When I was elected ACLU president, the New York Times had one of these little person in the news profiles, and the pull quote, corny, but I really believed it, they quoted me as saying, I want to emphasize the American in American Civil Liberties Union. This was right after George Bush the first had bashed then Democratic candidate Michael Dukakis for being a card-carrying member, Bob. You have to be careful where you brag about that. And my husband, who had sat through many of these lengthy, vociferous board debates, looked at that quote, and he looked at me and he said, I wish you would emphasize the civil in American Civil Liberties Union. So, and I'd like to thank my old colleague from Sullivan and Cromwell, Paul Mahoney. It's so wonderful to reconnect. And many thanks to my new friend Barbara and to Bob for those gracious remarks from all of you. I am so deeply honored to deliver this lecture named after such an outstanding person and professor, Henry J. Abraham. I find Henry's life story not only inspiring, but also heartwarming, especially because in many ways it mirrors that of my own beloved father, who was also born in Germany just 1 year later than Henry, who was also a victim of Nazi persecution, who also ultimately found refuge in the United States, and who also worked with the US military to gather evidence for the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal. Now, Henry has transmitted his abiding commitment to his adopted country's constitutional ideals, as Barbara said, not only to his own children, as my own dear father certainly did for me, but in Henry's case, that inspiration has been uniquely widespread. I would like to quote the closing words of the eloquent tribute to Henry that another distinguished UVA professor, David O'Brien, who is here today, published on the occasion of Henry's retirement from teaching. David wrote, Henry J. Abraham, like his biblical namesake, can justly claim to have been the intellectual father to multitudes of scholars, servants, and subjects of the law. And now you can add me, Henry. I am also grateful to the Thomas Jefferson Center, and in particular, Barbara and Josh, with whom it has been a great pleasure to work in arranging for this occasion, and to my longtime friend and colleague, Bob O'Neill. I'd like to thank you all for your important work, following in the footsteps of my great hero, Thomas Jefferson. Now, speaking of footsteps, I am honored to follow in the footsteps of my predecessors in this lecture series, with almost all of whom I went through the list, and I have had the chance to interact in various professional settings with almost every single one of the predecessors. For example, I have often debated my most immediate predecessor in this series, Antonin Scalia, and when I told him that I was using this opportunity to rebut what he said last year, he said that he would have to come back next year to deliver a reply. Now, that part is an April Fool's joke. But I would like to share a humorous story about Nino Scalia, which is completely true, and which sheds light on some of the serious differences between us about law and liberty, which are directly pertinent to my lecture topic. I'm fond of saying that Nino Scalia and I became friends not despite our strong disagreements on important issues, but to the contrary, precisely because of those disagreements, thanks to which we have been invited to debate each other in diverse forums all over the world. So the story in question concerns a conference in London where Justice Scalia gave a talk after the opening night dinner, and I was giving a rebuttal the next day. Throughout his after-dinner talk, Justice Scalia kept hammering home one of his favorite themes, namely that judges should confine themselves to strictly enforcing straightforward, inflexible laws and rules, not such open-ended, vague, wishy-washy concepts as inherent human rights. Well, this conference was taking place in a hotel, and Justice Scalia and I had agreed that we'd get together in the hotel bar afterwards for an after-dinner drink after his talk. I'd also invited another mutual friend to join us who happened to be in London at the same time for another reason. This was Floyd Abrams, the famous First Amendment lawyer and frequent Supreme Court advocate. So as you can imagine, the three of us were having a very lively conversation, and time was flying by as we were happily sipping our cognac and smoking our cigars. But when we ordered a second round, our waiter told us that he would not be able to serve us anything more due to an absolute strict law in London that no hotel bar may serve any alcoholic beverage to anyone who is not an overnight guest in that hotel after 11 p.m. And all three of us were staying at different hotels, not at the conference hotel. It was only a few minutes after 11, but the waiter insisted on strictly enforcing the letter of the law. So I couldn't resist shooting an accusing glare at Nino, who was already blushing, you know, and rubbing it in. See what you get when you insist on strict rules. So as a human rights activist, though, I had to persist in advocating our right to drink after 11. And I decided that my best bet would be to find somebody who was a hotel guest, get him to buy us the drinks, and then reimburse him. So I went up to the first person I saw at the bar. Excuse me, sir, I said, are you staying at this hotel? You're smarter than I was. He enthusiastically threw his arm around me and exclaimed, yes, doll, and I've got a king-size bed. Oh, I'm blushing. Well, we did get our drinks, and I don't think I had any long-term impact on Justice Scalia's hardline views. So this evening, I would like to discuss with you one of the hot-button issues that I have often debated with Justice Scalia, as well as other predecessors in this lecture series, including Jay Wilkinson, who is lovely, and I'm so glad to hear that he's here and get to talk to him again. The issue is what they label with the intendedly stigmatizing term judicial activism, namely vigorous judicial enforcement of constitutional principles, in particular rights that the Constitution does not explicitly enumerate in detail, but rather protects through broad norms and terms, including liberty and due process. To my mind, though, the term activism always has and should have positive connotations. For example, I'm proud to be described as a civil liberties and human rights activist. And one of my favorite quotes is from the poet and activist Alice Walker, when she said, "Activism is the rent I pay for living on this planet." Nonetheless, for many decades now, the term judicial activism has conveyed negative connotations, thanks to the conservative critics who have so vocally deployed it that way. Therefore, I was surprised to learn that these critics didn't actually coin the term. To the contrary, the term was initially launched into our political discourse by the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr., and there's a Kennedy connection for you, Barbara. But this happened long before he worked in the Kennedy administration. He used the term in a 1947 article he wrote for Fortune magazine. He used the term positively to describe trailblazing liberal justices such as Hugo Black and William O. Douglas. So I think it's long past time that champions of constitutional rights reclaim this much maligned term. We could invoke Nino Scalia's own cherished originalism, the topic of his Abraham lecture last year, and restore the originally intended meaning of judicial activism as an accolade rather than a criticism. For all of the political and media fulminating against judicial activism, unfortunately, there's been much less vocal concern about the less obvious but much greater dangers to our democracy that flow from the opposite phenomenon, which I will call judicial inactivism or judicial passivism, namely the court's failure even to review, let alone to remedy, too many serious constitutional and other violations by elected officials. The dangers of judicial inactivism are not obvious because they are couched in rulings that do not even substantively address the violations at issue. Instead, the rulings invoke various so-called justiciability doctrines, familiar term to lawyers, probably not to non-lawyers. Basically, these are doctrines which conclude that courts should not resolve the claims on the merits. And the result is that plaintiffs' complaints are dismissed, which has the same practical impact as a negative ruling on the merits. The plaintiffs get no relief, and the defendants are free to proceed with their challenged conduct unimpeded by any judicial sanction. In recent years, the United States Supreme Court and other federal courts have been increasingly invoking these kinds of door-closing doctrines to deny any judicial relief for many kinds of claims. On December 10th, 2010, which December 10th, as many of you know, is International Human Rights Day, the anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. On that day last year, just a couple of months ago, the ACLU issued a report on point which was entitled "Slamming the Courthouse Doors." It documents how access to justice has been curbed over the last decade, specifically for victims of civil liberties and human rights violations. The report details denial of access to the courts for indigent defendants on death row, inmates who were abused in prison, immigrants in unfair deportation proceedings, domestic violence survivors, and victims of racial discrimination, among others. By way of example, this evening, I'm going to focus on the post-9/11 war on terrorism, which has also been a war on civil liberties and human rights. To be sure, the Supreme Court and lower courts have reviewed and struck down some important post-9/11 measures that unduly expanded government power while unjustifiably restricting individual freedom. Nonetheless, in too many other cases, lower courts have held that challenges to these executive abuses post 9/11 are non-justiciable, thus permitting serious government abuses to proceed unchecked. And to compound the problem, the United States Supreme Court has repeatedly refused to review challenges to the lower court's door-closing decisions. So in the remainder of my talk, I'm going to elaborate first on the virtues of judicial activism and then on the corresponding vices of judicial inactivism. So let's start with restoring the luster to the concept of judicial activism. I'd like to quote a speech from one of my civil liberties heroines, and that's appropriate. We just finished Women's History Month. This quote powerfully explains why it is judges' highest duty to interpret the Constitution actively to promote the overarching libertarian purpose that the preamble to the Constitution lays out when it says that one of the prime purposes of we the people in establishing the Constitution is to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. The speech I'm going to quote from is by the leading suffragist and abolitionist Susan B. Anthony. After the Civil War, our Constitution's libertarian purpose was further enhanced through three amendments that added more protection for more rights for more people. And one of the new provisions declared that all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens. No state shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens. Susan B. Anthony forcefully argued that this language guaranteed women's right to vote. After all, women are persons, so that all women who are born or naturalized in the United States are thus citizens by virtue of this language. And what could be a more paramount privilege or immunity of citizenship than the right to vote? QED, right? So in the next presidential election, after this amendment was added to the Constitution in 1872, Susan B. Anthony led a group of women in Rochester, New York, to the polls to vote. But not only were she and her sister suffragists not allowed to exercise this basic privilege of all citizens, worse yet, they were arrested, indicted, convicted, and fined for the crime of unauthorized voting. In 1873, while Susan B. Anthony was being prosecuted for this alleged crime of trying to vote, she gave an eloquent speech which relied on not only the Constitution's newly added language post-Civil War, but also the notion of inherent or natural human rights that have infused our system from the beginning. Going beyond women's voting rights, Anthony's speech extols judges' responsibility to enforce inherent fundamental rights in general. So I want to share her echoing words, her enduring echoing words in support of judicial activism. She said, "Our government is based on the idea of the natural right of every individual member thereof to a voice and a vote. We throw to the winds the old dogma that government can give rights. The preamble of the Constitution says, we the people of the United States, in order to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution. It was we the people, not we the white male citizens, nor we the male citizens, but we the whole people who formed this union. We formed it not to give the blessings of liberty, but to secure them. Not to the half of ourselves and the half of our posterity, but to the whole people, women as well as men. We ask the judges, wherever there is room for doubt, to give the benefit to the side of liberty and equal rights. The true rule of interpretation under our Constitution is that anything for human rights is constitutional and everything against human rights is unconstitutional." Well, consistent with Susan B. Anthony's perspective, judicial activism is fully faithful to the vision of Thomas Jefferson and other founders. They shared the Enlightenment era belief in natural human rights, so-called because they are inherent in our human nature. Accordingly, the core central passage in the Declaration of Independence declares that all of us are created equal and endowed with certain unalienable rights. Obviously, when Jefferson wrote those words, they were only aspirational ideals. Our founders came nowhere close to realizing them in reality, but we still haven't done so. But we are much closer now than we were in the 18th century, and a major instrument in that progress has been the active enforcement of our Constitution by conscientious judges who honor its plain language and intent, both of which expressly protect rights beyond the specific examples it explicitly sets forth. This original meaning of including unenumerated rights as being deserving of constitutional protection by judicial enforcement is most clearly set out in the Ninth Amendment, which expressly underscores a theme that had pervaded the original Constitution. You all know it. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So, in short, the Constitution expressly recognizes that protected rights go beyond the specific ones that it explicitly lays out. And throughout our history, all Supreme Court justices, entirely across the ideological spectrum, have concurred that the Constitution does protect some implicit rights. They just disagree about exactly which ones those are. For example, even Justice Scalia, a self-described textualist, has voted to enforce rights that the Constitution does not explicitly enshrine, but that he has found to be implicitly protected. One recent example was in his 2008 majority opinion in D.C. versus Heller, where he read the Second Amendment's specific language about a well-regulated militia as protecting a very specific individual right that has nothing to do with the militia and that many experts believe to be inconsistent with the amendment's language and original intent, but that in any event is certainly not expressly authorized by the Second Amendment. So let me remind you what the Second Amendment itself says. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Contrast that language with Justice Scalia's interpretation of it in the Heller case. He wrote, "The Second Amendment surely elevates above all other interests the right of law-abiding, responsible citizens to use arms in defense of hearth and home." If one can fairly read the Second Amendment's quite detailed language to protect such specific gun rights that it doesn't explicitly set out, then a fortiori, even more strongly as we lawyers say, we certainly can fairly read the open textured due process clauses of the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments to protect specific rights that they don't explicitly set out. Surely we can read their unqualified references to the broad concepts of liberty and due process as protecting specific facets of liberty that they don't explicitly delineate. To quote their language, the key language of the due process clauses provide that government may not deprive any person of liberty without due process of law. Justice Brennan aptly described this phrase as deliberately capacious. In other words, reflecting the framers' deliberate decision to leave it broad and open-ended, not deciding that it would encompass specific aspects of liberty that it did not expressly enumerate. In fact, the Supreme Court has consistently read that phrase as protecting implicit rights concerning family and private life, ranging from parents' right to raise and educate their children to a woman's right to choose an abortion. The Supreme Court reaffirmed this long-standing understanding in a landmark 2003 decision, Lawrence versus Texas, an opinion that notably was written by Justice Anthony Kennedy, a conservative Catholic Republican who was appointed by that revered conservative Republican president, Ronald Reagan. And I stress those facts to underscore that judges across the ideological spectrum actively enforce implicit aspects of constitutionally protected liberty. Justice Kennedy's opinion in Lawrence broadly construed the Due Process Clause's concept of liberty to include the rights of all adults to choose our own sexual partners and sexual intimacies within the privacy of our own home, regardless of gender or sexual orientation. Justice Kennedy concluded that opinion by eloquently endorsing a dynamic, evolving concept of constitutionally protected liberty. Referring to the Due Process Clauses, he wrote, "Had those who drew and ratified these clauses known the components of liberty in its manifold possibilities, they might have been more specific, but they did not presume to have this insight. They knew times can blind us to certain truths, and later generations can see that laws once thought necessary and proper, in fact, serve only to oppress. As the Constitution endures, persons in every generation can invoke its principles in their own search for greater freedom." So this philosophy of broad and expanding constitutional rights actively enforced by the courts infuses our whole Constitution. The Constitution deliberately shields federal judges from direct political pressure so that they can serve as special guardians of the rights of individuals and minority groups. And this gets to the heart of a question I'm asked all the time about various ACLU cases, especially when we're defending the rights of a group that is unpopular with the majority of the community or the right to express an idea that is disliked by the majority of the community. And that's the typical situation because, believe me, if you say something that the majority agrees with, you're not likely to have your free speech rights suppressed. So I'm often asked, what about the rights of the majority? Isn't it unwarranted judicial activism to strike down measures that the majority supports? So we cannot too often remind ourselves that, to quote another great Virginian, James Madison, the Constitution does not permit tyranny by the majority. And at this point, I'm going to interject, go off my prepared lecture topic to refer to a specific example that was very timely and that I thought about when Bob gave me that very kind introduction about defending politically incorrect speech. Many of you know that the Supreme Court recently decided 8-1 to uphold the free speech rights of a speech that is particularly obnoxious to civil libertarians, and we in the ACLU have long been in the forefront of defending free, equal rights for LGBT sexual orientation minorities. So to come to the defense of the Westboro Baptist Church, whose website says it all, www.godhatesfags.org. But we, of course, came to their defense despite disagreement with their civil libertarian ideals and with their anti-civil libertarian ideals. And I particularly personally feel very proud about this, Bob, because not only has the Westboro Baptist Church opposed the ACLU and criticized us while asking us to defend their free speech rights, but so they just don't like the fact that we're defending other people's rights. That's typical. But they actually have attacked me personally. It's one of my favorite memories because they were picketing me with, I was speaking in Kansas not too far from their mother church, and they were picketing me with signs that they intended to be insulting, but that I took as backhanded compliments. One of the picket signs said, ACLU, nation's number one fag lobby, and I thought, yay! Now, Bob tells you I defend politically incorrect expression. I quote it as well, and I'm going to be quoting from them, so let me give you the background, and if anybody has tender sensibilities, I warn you, you might want to cover your ears before I get to the
punchline from the Westboro Baptist Church. So you know the acronym ACLU, of course, stands for American Civil Liberties Union, but many of our detractors make up other things that they say it stands for, and then they put those in graffiti and in fundraising letters for their own organizations, and they say that ACLU stands for everything from always causing legal unrest to all criminals love us. So at this demonstration, the Westboro Baptist Church had come up with another spin on our acronym. And I'm quoting them. They said ACLU stands for the Anal Copulators and Lesbians Union. Many years ago on our website, we did a competition for what we thought different things ACLU could stand for, and by my lights, the hands down winner was, "Aw, come on, lighten up." You see, I'm trying to honor that one. Well, you know, this I was talking about the bedrock constitutional philosophy that the majority may not deprive an unpopular minority even of the right to utter a very unpopular expression. And that concept of anti-majoritarianism, which also gets to the heart of why we need judicial activism, actively enforced rights that cannot be safely protected in the majoritarian branches of government, that concept was recently reaffirmed in another ACLU case before the Supreme Court from Kentucky. The court held that the First Amendment bars government from promoting the religious message in the Ten Commandments, as opposed to general messages against murder and so forth. In his dissent in that case, your last year's Abraham lecturer, Justice Scalia argued that because, and he added all the numbers up, he said if you add up all of the Christian Jews and Muslims in the United States, we have a substantial majority of monotheists, and therefore he concluded the government should be allowed to promote monotheism, belief in a single God. But Justice O'Connor retorted, "We do not count heads before enforcing the First Amendment." So given this deliberately capacious language that the framers chose for key constitutional provisions, there's no straightforward, mechanical, objective way to interpret them, so no judge could possibly decide any significant constitutional case without being an activist, without actively interposing her or his own interpretations and understandings. In short, without exercising judgment. As my students would say, duh, how can you be a judge without doing that? But this truism continues to be denied by the vocal critics of judicial activism. And that prompted an extraordinary and eloquent rebuttal from retired Supreme Court Justice David Souter in his commencement address at Harvard University last June. David O'Brien and I were talking about this. David brought it up, before the talk, coincidentally. I say that these remarks were extraordinary because Justice Souter had been very reticent about these kinds of issues throughout his Supreme Court tenure. So the fact that he felt so strongly moved to weigh in on these issues is very telling. He forcefully rebuts the anti-judicial activist claim that deciding constitutional cases should be a straightforward exercise of reading the Constitution fairly. And he quotes, he's quoting from Justice Scalia when he uses that phrase, and he calls it the fair reading model. Justice Souter set forth several forceful counterarguments to what he called this simplistic view. For lack of time, I'm going to share with you just a portion of his compelling remarks about just one of his counterarguments. For a more expanded version, you're going to have to ask Justice Souter to deliver next year's Abraham lecture. He explained, "The explicit terms of the Constitution create a conflict of values, and the explicit terms of the Constitution do not resolve any such conflict. A choice will have to be made, because the Constitution embodies the desire of the American people, like most people, to have things both ways. We want order and security, and we want liberty. And we want not only liberty, but equality as well. These paired desires can clash, and when they do, a court is forced to choose between them, between one constitutional good and another one. So now that I've explored the virtues of judicial activism, I'm going to elaborate on the other side of the coin, the vices of judicial inactivism or passivism. As I said, I'm going to illustrate this pervasive problem by focusing on the court's door-closing doctrines that have effectively immunized many executive abuses in the war on terror at the behest of both the Bush and Obama administrations. I've been kidded a lot about how Henry and Mildred are, one is conservative and one is liberal. And I think there may be disappointed. I'm not really liberal. I'm a civil libertarian. And we say a pox on all of your houses when you violate civil liberties. And unfortunately, both support for and violation of civil liberties cross all party lines. And sadly, there has been extremely little difference between the Bush and Obama administrations in the war on terror, excuse me. You may notice conservatives are crowing about that. I saw last week John Yoo, whom I debated once right on this very stage, was saying basically that every single theory of expansive executive power that he had advocated in the Bush administration has now been embraced by the Obama administration. And I'd have to say it's one point on which John and I would agree, that factual account. So for one thing, the government has too often been arguing that plaintiffs lack standing to assert their claims because they could not show that they personally suffered a particular type of injury, even though the plaintiffs demonstrably had suffered some severe injuries. Secondly, the government also has wrongly argued that plaintiffs' claims have become moot because the government had voluntarily ceased the complaint of conduct, even though the government maintained the option of resuming that conduct. Finally, and most regularly, the government has argued that post-9/11 cases cannot be litigated without an undue risk of revealing state secrets that will endanger national security, even when ample public information substantiates the claims and defenses. I'm going to use much of my limited remaining time to expand on the dangers of this distorted state secrets argument. But before I do that, I first briefly want to explain why judicial inactivism is especially dangerous in the context of a national security crisis such as the war on terror. Throughout history, during any such crisis, the executive branch has consistently exercised its power to the outer constitutional bounds and beyond in order to protect our nation's security. This pattern has been followed regardless of the political party or ideological bent of the president in power. So even if one assumes that a national security crisis does justify the executive branch's most vigorous exercise of its power to protect the nation, I'm willing to assume that. But that also means that the judicial branch then has a countervailing duty to exercise the judicial review power with corresponding vigor, the checks and balances, to ensure that the executive branch does not overstep its power and violate individual rights. The Supreme Court's 1944 Korematsu decision has been resoundingly repudiated because the majority justices uncritically accepted the government's unsubstantiated assertions that the massive internment of Japanese Americans was necessary to protect national security. We now know that those claims were fabricated. As Justice Jackson's dissent lamented in that case, a military commander may overstep the bounds of constitutionality, and it is an incident. But if we review and approve, that passing incident becomes the doctrine of the Constitution. Likewise, constitutional doctrine is also adversely affected by the even more extreme judicial inactivism that I'm discussing post-9/11, involving not just the deferential review that the court used in Korematsu, but no judicial review at all. After the 9/11 terrorist attacks, civil libertarians anxiously awaited indications of how actively or passively the Supreme Court would assert its judicial review power over claims of executive branch overreaching and individual rights violations in the name of the war on terror. Now we're almost a decade after the terrorist attacks. The court's record has proven to be mixed. On the one hand, in most of the major post 9/11 cases that the court has decided on the merits, it has curbed the government's excesses in the name of national security. The court set the tone for this robust judicial review of the executive branch's robust assertion of anti-terrorism powers in one of the first such cases, Hamdi versus Rumsfeld, in 2004. In much justly quoted language, Justice O'Connor's opinion declared, "A state of war is not a blank check for the president when it comes to the rights of the nation's citizens." On the other hand, so that's the glass half full, now the glass half empty. Since 9/11, the court has declined to review more than a dozen very important cases in which lower courts had rejected challenges to post 9/11 measures that unjustifiably expand government power and violate fundamental rights. I have to stress that, contrary to the way it's sometimes misdescribed in the media, when the Supreme Court decides not to review a case, that is not a ruling on the merits. But its practical impact is very similar. The lower court ruling remains good law, which therefore has binding precedential impact within the jurisdiction of that lower court, and it also has persuasive force nationwide. In terms of dangerous judicial inactivism, the greatest concern, as I indicated earlier, is the Supreme Court's failure to review lower court decisions that have rejected challenges to post 9/11 abuses on justiciability grounds, concluding that there is no judicial forum for the argument at all. That twofold, double-layered judicial inactivism constitutes a major exception to Justice O'Connor's bracing words. It does, in effect, give the executive branch a blank check. And I'm going to give you some examples. The court has declined to review, and it has therefore effectively authorized lower courts' failures to review compelling claims of serious abuses, including torture, abduction, forced disappearance, prolonged incommunicado detention in inhumane conditions, the indefinite military detention of a lawful U.S. resident without criminal charge or trial, sweeping surveillance of the electronic communications of United States citizens, blanket denial of public and press access to important court proceedings, barring individuals from public events at which top federal officials are speaking if the individuals are carrying signs or wearing T-shirts with messages that criticize these officials, and retaliation against internal whistleblowing by an FBI employee about security breaches and espionage within the FBI's counterterrorism programs. Not reviewed, therefore effectively immunized. The door-closing doctrine that has done the greatest damage effectively immunizing post 9/11 abuses is the distorted version of the state secrets evidentiary privilege. Now, along with other evidentiary privileges, the state secrets privilege is properly invoked only to shield specific evidentiary items from being used in lawsuits, but not to bar the suit altogether. Nevertheless, this privilege, which was only rarely invoked prior to 9/11, since then has regularly been invoked by both the Bush and Obama administrations. Every time I say something negative about the Obama administration, I get choked. To dismiss, so they're invoking it to dismiss the claims outright and to argue that that should happen, and unfortunately too many lower court judges have accepted that argument. The Supreme Court has directly discussed the state secrets privilege only in one case way back in 1953 called United States versus Reynolds. And we can learn a lot about how this doctrine functions and misfunctions from that one case. First of all, Reynolds provides no support for the recent recasting of this doctrine as an executive immunity decision. It was tort action brought by the widows of three civilians who had been killed in the crash of an Air Force plane. During the discovery, the plaintiffs sought the official Air Force accident report. The government declined to produce it, claiming that the plane was engaged in a confidential mission to test confidential equipment. Now, the Supreme Court did accept the government's argument that it should not have to produce this report, but the court concluded that plaintiffs could prove their case through the testimony of the surviving crew members, and which the government had offered to provide. And following the Supreme Court decision, the litigation did proceed and ultimately was resolved with a negotiated settlement. So the Supreme Court's upholding the privilege as applied to a particular piece of evidence did not result in the lawsuit ending, which is what's happening today. The Reynolds court was positive in that sense. It didn't treat the privilege as a door-closing doctrine, but the court did engage in undue judicial activism in one key respect. The government asserted that this material, this report, would jeopardize national security about this confidential mission in which the plane was engaged, and the court just accepted the government's word for it. It did not independently look at the report at all. Decades later, when the report was declassified, it turned out not to reveal the asserted details of a secret project, but instead what one historian decried as a horror show of governmental incompetence, bungling, and tragic error. The report explained how the engine failure that caused the crash could have been avoided, and it expressly finds that the Air Force had been negligent. As Justice Douglas declared in the landmark Pentagon Papers case, government officials regularly invoke national security concerns to suppress embarrassing information. The real fear is not danger to national security, but embarrassment. So the Reynolds case, unfortunately, illustrates the government's general tendency under any administration, any political party, to at least exaggerate, if not outright fabricate, the national security benefits of secrecy while overlooking the significant ways in which government secrecy actually undermines national security, not to mention undermining due process, accountability, and other essential democratic values. Indeed, after 9/11, you recall there was a very prominent bipartisan citizens commission to look into the causes of that disaster, which was chaired by Tom Kaine, former Republican governor of New Jersey, Lee Hamilton, former Democratic member of Congress from Indiana. And that citizens commission concluded that one of the causes of the disaster was excessive government secrecy. If the information that truly was not jeopardizing national security had been shared, it might have enabled government and private sector actors to connect the dots, so to speak. So despite these compelling reasons for Supreme Court review and overhaul of the misuses of the state secret privilege, post 9/11, the court has repeatedly refused opportunities to do that. The ACLU alone has been rebuffed by the court in three cases involving the state secrets privilege, three cases just since 2005. But in a statement that has been attributed to Thomas Jefferson, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. So in December, yet again for the fourth time, we have asked the Supreme Court to reevaluate this state secrets privilege in a case called Muhammad versus Jepson Data Plan, in which the Ninth Circuit upheld the distorted door-closing doctrine of the privilege by a closely split 6-5 vote. The five plaintiffs in this case were forcibly disappeared and flown to Afghanistan, Egypt, and Morocco, where they were detained incommunicado in inhumane conditions and tortured. The flights were arranged by Jepson Data Plan, which is a Boeing subsidiary, at the direction of the Central Intelligence Agency. And by the way, to demonstrate that the case could be litigated without jeopardizing state secrets, the ACLU submitted 1,800 pages of publicly available evidence to substantiate the claims and defenses, one of which quotes a Jepson Data Plan employee referring to the flights as the torture flights. Ironically, the severe costs of the inappropriate judicial inactivism in cases such as Jepson were stressed by none other than the six Ninth Circuit judges who misapplied the state secrets doctrine in that case. Here's what they said. Denial of a judicial forum based on the state secrets doctrine poses concerns at both individual and structural levels. For the individual plaintiffs, our decision forecloses judicial remedies. At a structural level, terminating the case eliminates an important check on abuses by governmental officials and contractors. Well, when even the judges who are practicing judicial inactivism stress its profound resulting harms to individuals and our nation alike, surely it is past time for the Supreme Court to come to the rescue, as we certainly hope it will finally do in the Jepson case. So in concluding my argument against judicial inactivism and for judicial activism, I'd like to quote the Supreme Court Justice, who I think is the greatest judicial activist ever to grace that bench, yet another great Virginian to boot, namely Chief Justice John Marshall. In justly famous lines, in that most famous activist decision, Marbury versus Madison, Marshall explains why the type of inactivism that we have seen post 9/11, namely denying a judicial forum, let alone a remedy, Marshall explains why that is fundamentally at odds with our system of government. So I'd like to end these remarks by quoting that famous passage in which he declared, "The very essence of civil liberty certainly consists in the right of every individual to claim a legal remedy by suit whenever that right is invaded. The government of the United States has been emphatically termed a government of laws and not of men. It will certainly cease to deserve that high appellation if the laws furnish no remedy for the violation of a vested legal right." Thank you very much.